Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo's Gaelic football team on the west coast of Ireland.
When you look at the amount of times they've reached a final, you almost start believing something's not right.
Believing in the curse.
Amazing sports stories. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 16th of December, these are our main stories. The Israeli military has expressed deep remorse over the deaths of three hostages held by Hamas in Gaza, who were killed after being mistakenly identified as a threat. The global shipping giant Maersk says it's suspending container traffic through the Red Sea after a spate of attacks by Houthi rebels in Yemen. And the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that age-old hatreds were resurfacing around the world with a vengeance. Also in this podcast, President Trump's former lawyer Rudy Giuliani is ordered to pay $148 million. And the Italians are up in arms.
These people should be locked up. Locked up. It seems crazy to me. It seems to distort what is traditional.
The Israeli military says it has killed three hostages who were being held in Gaza after they were mistakenly identified as a threat in a town in the north of the Gaza Strip. The victims have been named as Yotam Haim and Seima Talalka. Both were abducted by Hamas from kibbutzes in southern Israel. The family of the third hostage had initially requested that his name was not broadcast. Christian Fraser spoke to Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus from the Israel Defense Forces and asked him about the military operation in Gaza.
What I can add to your correct description of the very sad and tragic event is that a third hostage was mistakenly killed by Israeli troops. His name has been approved for public release. He was Alon Shamriz from Kfar Aza, who was also abducted on the 7th of October. And his family has, of course, been notified, and they have approved the release of his name. And, of course, the IDF has expressed our deepest regret towards the families of those fallen Israeli hostages. We are investigating the matter. We have already issued lessons and directives for our troops on the ground in order to minimize the chances of this happening again. And of course, we will continue to operate relentlessly in order to defeat Hamas despite this horrible and sad event. And we will not be deterred or delayed. And we will continue to fight Hamas until it is defeated and until security is returned to southern Israel.
I'm sure that the details around it will be subject to an inquiry. Is there any further information you can give us as to why they were mistaken for Hamas fighters? Were they in the vicinity of Hamas fighters? Were they dressed in a Palestinian way? Was there any other explanation for why they were shot and killed?
Yes, one of them is, well, there's actually two. One relates to their clothing. They were dressed in civilian clothing and probably in a similar fashion to what we have seen Hamas combatants, Hamas fighters or terrorists that have been fighting on the ground against Israeli troops all over the Gaza Strip, in Sajaiya, where this happened, and in other locations as well. We've seen Hamas fighters with RPG grenade launchers in their hands and AK-47s and IEDs dressed in civilian clothes. And that adds complexity to the situational awareness of our troops. And the second thing is that before and after this tragic mistake occurred, there were clashes between Israeli troops in the area and Hamas combatants. And that apparently was also part of the reasons for this very sad mistake.
Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus, a spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces. The bodies of the Israeli hostages have now been returned to Israel. Israel has announced it will open a new route for humanitarian assistance to enter Gaza. This will be the first time since October the 7th that supplies will be allowed to enter from Israeli territory. There's a desperate need for food, water and medicine in Gaza, but delivering that aid can be dangerous work, The United Nations agency UNRWA alone has said at least 135 of its staff have been killed since the war began. A member of another UN body, OCHA, has described the experience of carrying aid through an Israeli checkpoint. With the details, here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, who's in Jerusalem.
I've been talking to a British aid worker who took part in a joint UN-WHO convoy accompanying Palestinian medics making a very high-risk journey from the south of Gaza, from Rafah, up to the Al-Ahli hospital in the north. And to do that, they had to cross the checkpoint at Wadi Gaza, which is roughly halfway down the Gaza Strip. And it's the first time, certainly, that I've heard a first-hand account from somebody of what it's like to run the gauntlet of not only checkpoints, but airstrikes and debris and unexploded bombs on the side of the road, and the appalling conditions that were found inside that hospital of bodies and wounded lying side by side. So his account is fairly graphic, and this is what he told me. This is called Jake Morland from the OCHA.
We were crossing what is now a front line at what they call Wadi Gaza. It's an Israeli checkpoint, and we had to get through there with Palestinian colleagues. We were held there for well over an hour while the Palestinian paramedics were forced out of their cars, forced to stand in an extremely exposed area at huge risk to themselves, while they were profiled by these soldiers. And indeed, two of them were led away, where we understand one was put on his knees, stripped, and detained for some time until we were able to negotiate his release and carry on to Gaza City to do the job we were there to do.
You mentioned that one of the vehicles was shot at.
We saw not only unexploded ordnance on the road and on the sides of the road, making the trip all the more perilous, but we were also shot at. The ambulance took a couple of bullets, as indeed did our truck. So it really was putting humanitarian workers' lives on the line as they went to try and save lives.
What happened on the way back?
We were focused on the 19 critically injured patients. All of these patients had life-critical injuries, amputations, horrific wounds that needed immediate attention. We were held for over 2 hours at the checkpoint. The walking wounded were forced at gunpoint from the ambulance and again were stood in the sand to be profiled by the IDF. Even the children who were wounded and terrified, I must say, were carried out by the paramedics and stood there for over an hour while pictures were taken and while those who had been led away were questioned, we understand, stripped naked again at gunpoint.
And this was presumably after dark in the cold?
He was still detained, but we had patients who were literally dying because of all the delays that were being imposed on us. One of the patients died from his injuries on the way to a hospital in the south, a death that we think may have been avoidable had we been allowed free and fair access through the checkpoint.
UN aid worker Jake Morland speaking to the BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner. The BBC have asked the Israeli military for a response to this story, but are yet to receive one. One of the world's biggest logistics companies, Maersk, says it's pausing all container shipments through the Red Sea until further notice. The decision comes after a series of attacks on merchant vessels by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen, who say they're targeting ships traveling to Israel. On Friday, a vessel belonging to another shipping line was damaged after being struck off the Yemeni coast. Maersk said one of its ships narrowly escaped being hit on Thursday. Anita Anand spoke to Michael Scott Moore, who is an author and journalist. He was captured by Somali pirates when reporting on piracy in 2012.
It's incredible the amount of attacks in the last 48 hours. It's a strategic stretch of water that the Houthis have been taking advantage of since the war started in Israel and the Gaza Strip. And it's a little bit odd that Somali pirates seem to be piling in.
Let's separate this. So the Houthis are politicized extreme group based in Yemen. But the Somali pirates, are they at all politicized or are they just opportunists saying, okay, well, hey, you know, the Houthis are now, because they're firing rockets at ships, this place has turned into the Wild West and we can carry on where we left off?
Well, it's not clear. Certainly the Houthis are sponsored by Iran and are trying to involve themselves in the war on the side of Hamas against Israel. The Somali pirates, to the extent that they're involved, are probably just being opportunistic. Yeah. There was a hijacking about a week ago that seemed to involve five Somali pirates, and that ship reportedly was steered back towards Yemen. And if that's true, then that would be the first time anyone has heard of Somali pirates actually working on behalf of the Houthis. But today, it sounds like Somali pirates have actually captured another ship and are steering it towards Somalia. So that would just be opportunistic.
Has the Red Sea always been vulnerable? And now people are just taking advantage of loopholes that have always existed? Or has it all of a sudden become very much more vulnerable?
No, it's always been vulnerable simply because it's major narrowing of all the shipping lanes towards the Suez Canal. You have to, everyone has to go around the Horn of Africa if they want to go through, up into the Mediterranean from the Indian Ocean. They have to pass through the Red Sea and then in the other direction too. So the Somali pirates, when they started to catch large ships, were also being opportunistic about simply about their location. 300 years ago, it was European pirates, you know, it was American colonists pirates going out to that part of the world to take advantage of the same strait.
I mean, I sort of mentioned very briefly that you know what it's like. I mean, just remind people what you went through.
I went to Somalia in 2012 after I covered a trial of 10 Somali pirates in Germany. I was working for Spiegel Online and on a private reporting trip to write more about that trial, I went to the central Somalia and I got kidnapped on land. But it was a pirate gang that kidnapped me. And within a few months, they put me on board a ship they had hijacked. So I lived on a ship for about 6 months, too.
The author, Michael Scott Moore. A jury in the United States has ordered Donald Trump's former lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, to pay $148 million in damages to two election workers he falsely accused of vote tampering during the 2020 election in Georgia, a key battleground state in Mr. Trump's bid for re-election. Nomia Iqbal has more details.
A judge already ruled Rudy Giuliani spread false information about mother and daughter Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss. During the civil trial, they both described how their lives had been impacted after December 2020, when Mr. Giuliani first suggested that they had engaged in election fraud to turn the result against Donald Trump in Georgia, a critical swing state. The women said they were subjected to racist and threatening messages and phone calls, with people calling for them to be lynched, and even Miss Moss's teenage son was targeted. Rudy Giuliani did not testify at the trial, but his lawyer said he should not be held responsible for the abuse directed to the women. It's not known if Mr. Giuliani can actually pay the amount because he hasn't disclosed his net worth.
Nomia Iqbal. Here in London, the High Court has ruled that Prince Harry, King Charles's youngest son, was the victim of phone hacking by a major newspaper group. The court said it had found evidence of the widespread and habitual use of phone hacking at the Mirror Group newspapers. Prince Harry described it as a great day for truth and accountability. He was awarded the equivalent of $185,000 in damages. Prince Harry's lawyer, David Sherborne, read a statement from outside the court.
Today's ruling is vindicating and affirming. I've been told that slaying dragons will get you burned. But in light of today's victory and the importance of doing what is needed for a free and honest press, it is a worthwhile price to pay. The mission continues.
The court ruling could have significant implications for the wider media industry in the UK. However, as our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell reports, taking on the British press has been a high-risk strategy for Prince Harry.
Today's decision is a notable victory for Prince Harry. It will be seen as a vindication of the stand he's taken against branches of the British media. The intrusions, particularly when he was a child, scarred him, more so than in the case of other members of his family who've generally been able to move on. But in Harry's case, the sense that he's on a mission to reveal past misdemeanours by British tabloid newspapers has been driving him for years. The fact that he has both the financial means and the distance from the day-to-day work of the royal family has made it possible for him to pursue this and other court actions. How will other members of his family be feeling? One imagines that privately they'll be pleased that one member of the family has taken on a branch of the British tabloid media, albeit for activities in the past, and won. However, it's unlikely to mitigate the feelings of deep disappointment felt by the family at the behaviour of the Sussexes and their tendency to make public their many complaints about the way they believe they've been treated.
Nicholas Witchell. Still to come.
The sales is traditionally done for these 50 years in our coffee shops. The culture, the growth, and also the distribution of the cannabis remains illegal.
How the Netherlands is starting a trial to decriminalise the production of cannabis.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler, and this is The Global Story from the BBC World Service.
China and America came together and agreed on this climate issue.
We're here to look beyond the headlines, peel back lazy assumptions, and give you a fresh global perspective on the stories that matter.
Is Europe tiring in terms of its support for Ukraine?
There will have to be some kind of negotiation to end this war.
Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The UN's World Food Programme is warning that a humanitarian crisis in Sudan is worsening as fighting between the paramilitary rapid support forces and the Sudanese army intensifies south of the capital, Khartoum. Lenny Kensley is the World Food Programme spokesman for Sudan.
Today we mark a grim milestone. 8 months since a horrific war erupted across Sudan, which is showing no sign of abating. That's 8 months of terror, violence, displacement, and immeasurable suffering that the Sudanese people have had to endure in what is becoming one of the world's worst humanitarian crises.
For more on the background to the fighting, I've been talking to our correspondent, Kalkadin Yepotal, who's in Addis Ababa.
The fighting is between two armed groups, the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary group. Now, these two armed groups were allies and they were governing the country in collaboration after overthrowing a civilian government that followed the ousting of a long-time dictator in the country. So it seems that there was a power struggle between the leaders of these two groups, and this fighting is continuing for 8 months now. So far, it was concentrated in the capital, Khartoum, and a city nearby, as well as in the western part of the country, in Darfur.
So what is actually happening on the ground around Khartoum at the moment?
What we're hearing is an area which is called Al Jazeera, which is found south of the capital Khartoum, and which used to be a safe haven for many people who are fleeing the violence, is the latest hotspot after fighters of the Rapid Support Forces attacked it, and then there was an incursion by their fighters.
And after 8 months of fighting, are either side getting any upper hand in this?
It seems that the rebel, the Rapid Support Forces, were having some momentum in Darfur area, in the western part, while the government, the armed forces, had control in the capital, in Khartoum. And now it seems that they're fighting for the control of the capital, Khartoum, as well as this area called Al Jazeera, which is found south of the capital.
Now, the WFP, as we heard a bit earlier, says this has become a forgotten war, and the UN is warning that 30 million people, which is two-thirds of the population, are in need of assistance.
Absolutely. It's a really forgotten war. Now, the World Food Programme is saying that 18 million people, it said, that are facing acute hunger. And now this fighting is happening as the country is approaching its rainy season, where farmers were supposed to do their farming. So if their farming are interrupted by this fighting, the people in need of aid in the coming months could increase. Also, that we must remember that around 7 million people are pushed out of their homes. Many of them are seeking refuge in neighboring countries like Chad and Egypt and South Sudan. Others are internally displaced. So this is a massive humanitarian need in Sudan right now.
Kalkadin Yepotal. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that human rights are under attack while praising those who defend them. Mr. Guterres said age-old hatreds, from racism to xenophobia and religious intolerance, were resurging with a vengeance. He was speaking at a ceremony marking the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a clarion call to act in accordance with the fundamental truth that each of us is an equal member of a single human family. 75 years on, the world must recall that wisdom, and it must act on it, because human rights are under attack around the world.
Meanwhile, a UN report says the Taliban government in Afghanistan is putting women survivors of domestic abuse in prison, claiming it's for their own protection. The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan says the authorities have closed all 23 state-sponsored women's shelters because they see no need for them. The report says levels of gender-based violence against Afghan women and girls were high even before the Taliban retook control 2 years ago. But it says the economic and humanitarian hardships afflicting Afghanistan since then have made the problem worse. Matthew Amriliwala spoke to Heather Barr from Human Rights Watch and asked her for her reaction to the Taliban's actions.
This report documents what Afghan women have known since August 15, 2021, which is that one of the first things the Taliban did after they took over was to dismantle the whole system that had been put in place by the government and NGOs to respond to violence against women. It took them a bit longer, but after that, they largely dismantled the legal system. And so, you know, there's been more attention to them banning girls from education, women from work, but this is an important piece, too, of their systemic deprivation of the rights of women and girls. And that crackdown is continuing and getting worse as we speak.
The Taliban officials have said they would ask male members of the family to make, quote, a commitment not to harm women survivors of abuse. Even when I read that out, that seems absolutely extraordinary.
I mean, the Taliban have sent a very clear message that women are the property of their male family members. They've also said that, you know, if women go out and are not dressed as the Taliban thinks they should be, they'll punish the male family members rather than the women themselves. So women are in this situation where their male family members are really being seen by the Taliban as their owners and their keepers. It's an impossible situation for them, and they've been waiting a long time for the international community to respond appropriately to this very serious crisis, yes, which is the worst situation for women in the world right now.
I'll come back to that thought in a moment, but shelters, they have been closed. Are there any sort of safe spaces for women left?
Well, you know, one safe space that existed until a couple months ago was beauty salons, which, you know, that might sound silly, but it was actually one of the only spaces where women could go and speak to other women, get advice, perhaps get some kind of protection. The Taliban closed them about 3 months ago at a cost of 60,000 jobs for women and also the loss of one of the only spaces left where women could get help from other women.
Briefly on this, what sort of stories are you hearing in your organization emerging as a result of everything that we've been talking about?
Well, it's important to say that if women are fleeing violence and are sent to prison, their cellmate may well be a women's rights protester, because one of the things that we're seeing is that the Taliban are arbitrarily detaining and really forcibly disappearing a large number of women's rights protesters. We've spoken to some of them who have eventually been released after having been tortured in prison. These are the women who come out on the streets and protested against the Taliban's policies and tried to get the world to pay attention.
And you mentioned the international community. I mean, it appears that they have few levers. What do you think, in addition, should be being done here?
Well, Malala Yousafzai gave a speech in South Africa 10 days ago where she said that the world should recognize the situation in Afghanistan as gender apartheid. I think that one of the things the international community needs to do is avoid normalizing this and kind of moving on and forgetting about the situation. Afghan women feel very, very forgotten,
yes,
by the entire world, and they want people to realize that what happens, yes, to them has implications for women's rights globally.
Heather Barr from Human Rights Watch. Participants at a major UN forum aimed at finding solutions to the global refugee crisis have pledged more than $2.2 billion to help refugees and the countries that host them. The head of the UN Refugee Agency, Filippo Grandi, said the forum in Geneva wasn't just about giving aid to refugees, but allowing them to tell the world their own stories and suggesting their own solutions.
I cannot help but think that we were even more energized by the participation of the more than 300 refugees here. Allow me to ask those refugees, or former refugees and stateless people to please stand so we can salute your spirit.
At a time when the numbers of refugees worldwide have reached record highs, thousands of delegates from nearly 170 countries attended the three-day event. I heard more about the pledges from the BBC's Janat Jalil, who's in Geneva.
These pledges came from a host of organisations, from businesses, philanthropic foundations, as well as governments. But it's not just about financial help. The head of the UN Refugee Agency said the private sector had also pledged to create thousands of jobs for refugees. And states have also pledged to resettle 1 million refugees by the year 2030. But with unprecedented numbers of people displaced by conflicts in Ukraine, Sudan and Myanmar, as well as many other places, that still leaves some of the world's poorest countries hosting the majority of refugees.
And it's only the second time this global refugee forum has been held. How did it differ from the first one 4 years ago?
Yes, this time there was more emphasis on hearing from refugees themselves and how they were helping themselves and each other. There's a special award which is given for helping refugees. It went to Somalian-born Abdullahi Mire. Now, he grew up in a refugee camp, but he then became a journalist and he set up a project that has seen more than 100,000 books distributed to children in that same refugee camp. And we also heard from an Afghan woman, Khalida Popal, who overcame huge opposition in her home country to found and then captain the women's football team, only to then be forced to flee once the Taliban seized back power. She used sport not just to help herself, but also to help other refugee women connect with each other.
To use the power of sport and education, where we change the narratives around women, around refugees, around sports, to be the role models, but also share the positive message to the world by showing if we get the opportunities and possibilities and one hand of help, then we can make an impact.
So we've seen lots of ambitious pledges being made to help people like Khalida. But last time round, there were similar pledges made. More than $2 billion were pledged last time round. It's not clear that all of those were honoured. This time round, the UN Refugee Agency says that it's established mechanisms to ensure that that money will be paid at a time when funding for aid agencies is falling to very low levels. It's not just about the money that's being pledged, but it's in the way that it's being used to help refugees at a time when there is more emphasis now on trying to get them to do things for themselves and to try to give more back to the communities that host them.
Janat Jalil in Geneva. The Netherlands is starting a trial to decriminalise the production of cannabis. The four-year experiment will start in two cities, Breda and Tilburg. The consumption of cannabis in small quantities has long been allowed in the Netherlands, but the production of the drug remained illegal, even though it was often tolerated. The aim now is to crack down on drug dealers and guarantee a high-quality and safer product for consumers. Tim Frank spoke to Ernst Kuipers, the Dutch health minister.
We have had a policy in the Netherlands already now for approximately 50 years in which we tolerate the sales, the possession of limited amounts and also the use of cannabis. And the sales is then traditionally done for these 50 years in our coffee shops. But this has created a somewhat, I would call it, schizophrenic situation because the culture, the growth and also the distribution of the cannabis remains illegal. And that, from a health perspective, creates a situation in which, other than with all other consumer products, which are strictly regulated and controlled for reasons of consumer safety, for cannabis, there is no such situation. I have no control over the growth. I have no control of the presence of pesticides or other products within the cannabis. And so the main thinking for starting this project is to try and completely control and regulate the whole process from growth, distribution to end use.
How is that going to work, though, in terms of just trying to ensure that what is grown for sale in these two cities doesn't then just end up elsewhere? You're saying you're creating a closed system, but it would be difficult enough to control within the Netherlands. And then, of course, you've got open borders to the rest of the European Union.
Sure.
So what we're doing is that we selected a total of 10 commercial growers who are then strictly controlled. They have to keep track of all their production. So it's a fully track and trace system from the original plant and the original grower to the ultimate end user, the consumer. And that allows us to strictly control that indeed there is no materials passing cross borders, entering when the Netherlands an illegal market.
Ernst Kuipers, the Dutch health minister. Now, if there's one thing Italians get worked up about, it's food. You mess with Italian food at your peril. And yet, one Italian food historian has done just that. He posted a video of himself making what he describes as the original version of carbonara, and it's substantially different from what the world understands the dish to be. And to say some Italians are a bit annoyed would be an understatement, as Chantal Hartl explains.
Avete mai preparato la carbonara originale, la prima vera carbonara?
Luca Cesari, a Bologna-based writer, proudly shows off his creation, a dish he says was inspired by the first carbonara recipe published in an Italian cookery magazine in 1954. Instead of using eggs, cured ham, and Italian pecorino cheese, which are key to what many consider the country's flagship dish, he's using Swiss Gruyere cheese, bacon and scrambled eggs. In a follow-up video, Cesari says he's been abused online for daring to recreate a historical recipe. This has angered the carbonara purists who didn't study history and think that our beautiful recipe has always remained identical to itself. Unfortunately, this is not the case. There have been hundreds of versions of carbonara. Well, it is unclear where the origins of the carbonara truly lie. People in Rome had very strong opinions on Cesari's adaptation.
These people should be locked up. Locked up. It seems crazy to me. It seems to distort what is traditional. Let him eat it.
Even after the backlash, Cesari says he will recreate another Italian classic, a traditional Neapolitan pizza from the 1800s, with clams.
Chantal Hartl with the old-fashioned way of producing carbonara. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, here's Harry Bly with news of the Happy Pod, which this week has been recorded at the UN Global Refugee Forum with some uplifting and inspiring stories.
Yes, we're in Geneva this week. I spoke to the winner of the UNHCR's Nansen Award, Abdullahi Mire. He set up a book drive in the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, where he grew up, and that's now helping local children get an education. Also, the woman who became an Olympic cyclist after fleeing Afghanistan, now she's her team's chief at the Paris Games in 2024. And the doctor, who's using technology in his mission to heal war-related traumas. Join me for half an hour of uplifting stories in this podcast feed on Saturday.
If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.